Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. This week, it is all about you, dear listener. I am joined for the next hour by CBS Money Watch Editor-at-Large Jill Schlesinger, and we will be answering your questions. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am really psyched to talk personal finance.
Fantastic. We've got all sorts of questions for you to answer, but first, some questions for you. A pop quiz. You ready?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so what comes first, retirement funds or emergency funds?
Easy, emergency funds.
Ding, 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 ding. All right, when is it appropriate to raid your 401k?
Only in a life or death emergency, and even then, pay yourself back.
All right, you got 2 out of 3 so far. Which should I pay down first, credit card, student loan, or mortgage?
How about the one that has the highest interest rate? We'll get that one cleared up first.
All right, you're hired. Great lightning round coming up on the broadcast. Questions, questions, and more of your questions on Marketplace Money from APM. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM. We're going to do something a little different this week. You know, we've spent a lot of time answering your questions throughout the years, but it's been a while since we purely did that for an entire hour, and that is what we are going to do today. We're going to take your questions, hopefully have a few answers for you along the way, and joining us in that effort will be our good friend Jill Schlesinger of CBSMoneyWatch.com. Hello again. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to be with you.
Are you ready to answer some questions?
I am fired up, ready to go. I got my old CFP manual. You know, I had to swear an oath on the CFP Board of Standards something before we came on here. So I've moved from broadcasting back into my old role as financial planner.
Well, you know, I think our questions tend to run, these days at least, a lot toward people trying to figure out what they're going to do about retirement, whether they're going to be able to retire, about investing. Nobody can understand what's going on with the market these days. So let's see what our callers have to say at this point. And Courtney is with us from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Courtney.
Hi.
What do you do there?
Right now, I am a nursing student.
Oh, my goodness. That's so interesting. You know, I was in Detroit earlier this year doing a story on former auto workers who were becoming nurses. Do you have any auto workers in your classes?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
We've all been so busy that
right.
We're all just kind of nose to the books right now.
Right. So you're getting no sleep whatsoever.
Nope.
No sleep.
You know, Tess, I was thinking about medicine except for the fact I don't like needles, knives, or blood. I really thought I'd be great at it.
I'm with you there. I think that would have been a problem, though.
Mm.
If we have a problem with those things, we're probably not going to be very good in medicine.
Darn it.
Well, so Courtney, how are your finances doing?
They're doing good, or they're doing okay.
Yeah.
I know my major question was about 17 months ago, Mark and I purchased a Jeep Patriot, and that was replacing his old car that had over 200,000 miles on it.
Wow. Good for you. You literally ran it into the ground, huh?
We did. We really did. And so we started out by trying to find a gently used vehicle, and we were finding that it was an extremely tight market. We looked and looked for months and could not find anything.
Yeah, this is actually amazing. A recession outcome has been that people are hanging on to their cars longer. There's not as many really good, gently used vehicles for sale, so that does not surprise me.
We had purchased our Ford Explorer as a lease turn-in, and it was a wonderful. And so just a few years later, we were very surprised to find out that we couldn't find a gently used car, which caused us to purchase the brand new one, which we then put about $8,000 down.
And how much was the car?
About $28,000, I think.
Okay, well, that's a good chunk then.
Just recently, we discussed selling it to kind of get out from that $322 a month payment.
But then what would you do? Do you have another car lined up?
We don't have another car lined up. So we would have to sell this car and try to get by on one car. Lansing and East Lansing, they're not really set up to use a lot of public transportation, unfortunately. So we would kind of, now we've done it before and it has been very tight. So that being said, we are definitely a kind of a two-car family. Then I was just wondering, would we lose the bulk of what we put into it?
Have you checked the Kelley Blue Book?
I have not yet done that.
Okay, because you can do that. You can go online and basically find out what your car is currently worth, and then you can figure out, you know, with that $8,000 down payment and all the other payments that you've made so far, kind of where you are in terms of, I guess, equity in your car versus depreciation.
And right. I'm just wondering, how much longer do you have in nursing school?
I just started.
So how many years is that ahead of you?
The program I'm in runs 2 years.
I mean, I guess that, like, if you wanted to grid it out and share the car, it possibly, I'm not sure it's really going to be worth it because of the depreciation. I guess the other question is that 2 years from now, aren't you going to need two cars?
Yes, we will.
I don't know, Tess. This seems like a short-term way to save some money, no doubt, but is there other...
That's what I was kind of wondering, you know. That was my big fear. Yes, that we've relieved ourselves of the $322 payment, but then, you know, in 2 years, we're kind of right back to where we started.
I'm going to say the unfinancial planner point of view here is this seems like just not that great a decision for me. I mean, I know you could save money by getting rid of the car. It also seems like you're going to be under a lot of pressure in school. You're going to be probably working some hard hours eventually. And I don't know, Tess, what do you think? It feels to me like this is just not enough bang for the buck that you're going to save.
I agree. I mean, you have to factor in your time and having to worry about, well, how are we going to get here when we don't have the second car? And, you know, I have this that I have to get to. And, you know, so sounds to me like you've got a decision here. It's already made.
I do. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Courtney, thanks so much for the call.
Well, thank you for listening.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
We're back taking your calls with Jill Schlesinger of CBS Money Watch, and Joanna is on the line from Hammond, Indiana. Hi there.
Hi, Tess.
Well, what do you do there?
I work from home, actually.
Oh, that must be nice.
Yes, it is.
Although, so I have to say, when I think about working from home, I always wonder if I would have the self-discipline to actually sit down and get my work done.
Oh, sure. Don't get me wrong. You'll catch me, dusting as I go up the stairs to my office. Are you kidding me?
Right. All right. Well, what's your question for us today, Joanna?
Well, I have three young boys, mm-hmm. and I'm a single mother, and I want to know how best I can save the little money that I do have.
For any specific purpose?
Specifically current, like short term, is there extracurricular activities? Mm-hmm. And long term, obviously, education.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sort of savings account already?
I do.
You do?
I have simply the checking and savings. Mm-hmm. And then I have my 401k. And then in addition to that, I have a traditional IRA.
Oh, good for you. That's I'm glad great. To hear about all those retirement accounts.
Yay.
Yay for you. How about any debt out there in the universe? Anything scary that looms?
I am so proud to tell you that I have just paid off all my credit cards.
Yay.
Awesome.
I do not have a car payment.
Wow, that's
and
great.
I recently just refinanced.
Ooh,
and
nice.
Went from an 8% loan, 30-year. Uh-huh. To a 3.5% loan,
bang!
15-year.
For your mortgage.
On my mortgage.
Great.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So how's the cash flow after you did that? You went from a 30
Zero.
To a 15.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's the hard part, is I of course, had to pay $27,000 to receive that 3.5% interest rate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it cut my security blanket completely out of the picture. So now my savings account is at minimal, and I just really need to make it grow as fast as I possibly can.
And have you gone through and done the horrendous exercise of your expenses or budgeting or anything like that?
All of that. All of that.
It's brutal, isn't it?
It is. It is brutal, but it's amazing how utilities companies and security, for instance, a security company can be so warm and full of humanity. You're going through difficult times right now. We'll lower your payment for 6 months.
Mm.
So that's been very helpful. I've done that with all my expenses.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Yes.
So what, if any, room do you have in your monthly budget to set something aside?
I do. $150 a month is going from my checking account into my savings account, basically thinking $50 per child.
That sounds great.
Okay, good.
Yeah, definitely.
How much money is in the savings account? Have we gotten you to, once you refied and it cost you money to do that, have we gotten you back up to your 6 to 12 months of expenses in that savings account yet?
You're going to be mad at me. No.
I'm never mad at anyone.
$1,100.
All right. Well, but you know, so what's kind of cool about it is, although, you know, I know you're thinking about the kids, I'm thinking about Joanna. And
okay.
I want you to think about this as well, is that before you even start thinking about how I'm going to save for college for these kids, the first thing that you do after, and you've already done the debt pay down, you've done the hard part, is to now replenish that savings account so you have 6 to 12 months of emergency reserve fund in there. And once you get to that point, and then you start talking about, hey, what do I do in terms of college and those things, it's almost a separate conversation. But I think that's really your first step coming out of this next phase in your life.
Okay, first focus is the emergency, have that covered, and then move on.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay,
always.
Great.
Always.
Great.
And I'll dangle one thing out for you.
Thank you.
Indiana happens to have a very interesting Section 529 plan. So if you have parents who want to help with your kids' education or push some money in there, you know, it's holiday time, I want to give the grandkids a gift or something like that. The Indiana 529 plan, Tess, check this out. I looked it up.
Yeah.
Has a tax credit on a state level that you can basically, if you put money into the plan, you can take 20% of what you put into the plan and get a state income tax credit. So you can basically get $1,000 back every year for every $5,000 that gets put in there.
That's
so
amazing.
It's a sweet deal. Most of the state plans don't have that kind of credit. They might have a state income tax deduction. This is a real credit. So when you're ready to do it, you've got a beautiful choice that's right there within your state. You go directly to the plan. Don't have an advisor do it for you because you don't need to pay someone a commission to basically buy a Vanguard fund for you inside of a 529 plan.
Hmm.
And for all of your hard work, guess what? The state will give you a little bonus and take some money off your tax bill.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so that actually makes you really lucky, Joanna, because there are many 529 plans in various states that will not do that. So sounds like you've got a good one there. Yeah,
I am checking it out immediately.
All right, but emergency fund first.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
So let's go to Kelly, and she is in Arlington, Virginia. Hi there.
Hi.
What do you do there in the Beltway?
I work at a professional membership association.
Really? So you're not in the government, huh?
Nope.
You must be one of the few there.
There's enough of us in nonprofits around here as well.
Right. Oh, so a nonprofit.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's wonderful. I love any fellow nonprofit worker. Just doing it for the love of the work, right?
That's right.
Not necessarily for a big paycheck. All right. So what can we help you out with today?
Well, I have a question that I think is about competing priorities.
Uh-huh.
In November, I will have paid off my undergrad student loan.
Well, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, I've been out of school for 13 years, so
Can we ask how much you owed when you left school?
You know, I didn't owe very much. I owed about $10,000.
That's still a good chunk of change.
Yeah, but I did some national service and went to grad school, so I didn't have to pay on my loan for quite a few years.
Okay. Oh, so now you've got a grad school loan then, too?
I do, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so that is my question. So I have been paying about $300 on my undergrad loan because I wanted to get rid of it. And, I could add that $300 to my graduate school loan payment so that if I did that, a financial calculator told me that it would be paid off in about 5.5 years.
Versus?
18 years if I keep going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the idea of paying it off in such a short period of time would be great.
Yeah.
However, you know, there's always stuff I could save that $300 for. For example, a home.
Yeah. Ah.
I don't own a home right now, but I'm 35, and the idea of, you know, having a loan, a student loan forever, mm-hmm. is not my favorite thought, but
it's just 18 and a half years. It's not forever.
Right.
Right. Right. No, no. But also the idea of saving for a home, $300 extra per month for a home is, you know, is a lot of money.
Right.
Additional per month.
What kind of interest rate do you have on your student loan?
It's really low. It's 2.625%.
Nice.
Wow. That's hard to justify paying that off, isn't it? Oh,
boy. That's my feeling, too. But the idea of having a student loan for a really long time.
Right. How do you feel about having that debt as part of your life for the next 18 years?
It does not feel good.
Yeah.
Well, let's ask another question here for a second. Do you rent right now? What's the living situation today?
Yeah, I pay rent to my boyfriend.
How is he as a landlord? Just kidding. does your boyfriend own something? Is that what's happening?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So boyfriend owns a place. You're paying rent. And because I'm sure he's not listening, we're, of course, talking about something for the two of you. Not that you're like, you know what? I got to get my own place. I'm sick of him, right?
Exactly.
Okay,
he bought
I gotcha.
His place on his own, so it fits him pretty well. Mm-hmm. I fit in, too, but it's a little tight.
Okay. Hmm. And how much money do you have saved right now? I mean, you're working, and I imagine things are okay. Your expenses doesn't sound like it's too onerous, but what do you have saved up so far?
I have $43,000.
Ooh.
In a liquid savings account?
Yes.
That's good.
Well done.
That's really good. How about retirement? Because usually the one benefit of the nonprofit world should be that you're getting some nice matching contributions for a retirement account.
Yep. I have about $103,000 in retirement.
Oh, that's pretty good, right,
yeah,
Tess?
That is very good, especially if you've also got $43,000 in a savings account.
So, well, how much money would a new place cost? Let's crunch some numbers pretty. Let's do a quick financial plan. How much would you have to spend to get a place that the two of you would really want?
$600,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
D.C. is pretty expensive.
Yeah, it sure is.
So you're looking potentially at $100,000 plus down payment.
Yeah.
Only 60 from her, though.
Oh, yeah. Only 60 from her.
Well, wait. How about does boyfriend have equity in the current place? Does he have a bunch of equity in that current place?
Not a bunch, but a little bit.
Hmm. I'm going to try to split the difference here, Tess. I get that you're feeling a little bit anxious about carrying debt for 18 and a half years. I think it is highly unlikely that you will have 18 and a half years more on this loan. I really don't. I don't think so. But it does. I get that it bugs you.
What makes you say that, Jill?
That it bugs her or that?
No, that she won't have it for 18 years.
Because she's going to pay it down faster. She just doesn't want it. This is a woman who paid down this.
Yep.
She put that extra money down on the undergraduate loan while she was doing lots of different things. The habit is already there. I'll tell you what, Kelly, you're good at saving and you're good at paying down debt. And so I would not be afraid of you having, I just don't think you're going to, I'm not sure it's 5.5 years, but, in trading parlance, we would be a 5.5 bid at 18. It's going to be somewhere between that time horizon. If you really want to smack it down and get it done in 5.5 years. You know what you're giving up. You're saying, okay, I'll stay in the boyfriend's place. I'll do the best I can saving. I'll crank away. At 2.9%, it's very hard to think like, oh, I have to pay this down immediately. But you do have this competing interest, which is I want to buy a home. And so I'm wondering whether we can split the difference. You had $300 a month. So why don't you put an extra $150 down on the grad school loan and put an extra $150 into the savings account? And I think that you already have $40,000 in savings. I would never want you to deplete your savings. But if you think that you're probably a third of the way there towards a down payment, chances are you're going to get there. And as much as everybody really is freaking out and saying, oh, my God, I have to buy a house right now. Rates are really low. Well, we do know that rates are going to be low for another couple of years, and they're probably not going to go straight up from there. It's really more important that you secure your financial foundation. And I think that's what you're doing. I think you're really on the right track. It sounds like an awesome situation.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah. So does that help you out?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call and good luck.
Great. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Let's go next to Sonia, and she is in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi there.
Hi.
Is it still the middle of heat season there in Birmingham?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Excellent.
I thought there were only two seasons in Birmingham, football season and not football season.
We're in the middle of football season right now.
Roll Tide, right?
Exactly, Roll Tide.
Well, so what do you do there in Birmingham?
Well, I actually, I'm from Birmingham, and I just recently moved back home. So I'm in the process of looking for a job.
Oh, where were you?
I was in Chicago.
So why did you decide to leave the second city?
I'm from Birmingham, and so I moved to be closer to my family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what's your question for us today?
Well, I initially contacted you before I moved because I was questioning what to use my retirement from where I had been working for my moving expenses to offset my moving expenses.
Oh, so you wanted to withdraw from your retirement fund to pay for your move?
I did because it was fairly nominal, and I knew I would never be in that system again. So I just felt that maybe it would be better used for my move.
How do you define nominal?
Oh, like $2,200, $2,500.
Oh, but that $2,500, imagine what it could be in 30 years. Right, Jill?
I love that. I was just thinking. Or I'm thinking like to a nominal, $2,500. Like, let's say I was walking down the street. I walk out and I'm like, oh, I'm on 3rd Avenue. Look, $2,500. Oh, it's nominal. I'm not going to pick it
just,
up.
Yeah, just walk right by.
I mean, that's a pretty good chunk of money. So did you do it or not?
Well, actually, I put in the request for it, and it never went through. It hasn't gone through.
Thank goodness. This is good.
This was a message from the fates, from this the retirement fates.
And that was
fates.
My next question was maybe it was whether I should just leave it at this point.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do they allow you to roll it over? In other words, that's $2,500 that is your money. And
right.
Could you potentially roll that into an IRA rollover if you wanted to?
I could.
I love that idea. And I'll tell you why. You take the $2,500 bucks and you are under the age of 59 and a half. So you're whacked with a penalty and then you're whacked with taxes on the money because the money's not been taxed. And all of a sudden, $2,500 really does become more nominal. It becomes, you know, something like $1,500 in a hurry, maybe
right.
Even $1,250. And I'm just not really psyched about giving Uncle Sam money. I am a patriotic woman, but I would not be really that willing to give extra money to the government because you're moving. So what I would suggest is when you have an old retirement account, whether it is a pension or a 403B, is that you do something that's called an IRA rollover. You open up a new account at, you know, some no-load mutual fund house, you know, a T. Rowe Price, a Vanguard, a Schwab, someplace like that. And what you literally do is you electronically instruct the pension fund money to flow into this new account, and it keeps the tax protection. It's still a tax-deferred account. And you put something in it that is maybe a balanced fund or a target date fund or a little bit of a stock fund and a little bit of a bond fund. Keep it an index fund. And don't touch it because it's just not worth it to take these funds out at this point and really pay through the nose to Uncle Sam.
Right.
Does that make sense?
And it's a pretty easy process. I mean, you just fill out some paperwork and the money, it rolls over, which is why it's called a rollover.
And I know it's really always tempting to do that. It's just that, you know, if you had if I said, okay, here, you can have $2,500, you know, to roll into this account, or you can have $1,250. There's no way you're going to pick $1,250, but that's essentially what's happening. So I just think it's a kind of a sucker bet to take that money out of the account right now.
Okay.
So there you go, Sonia.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
And we are back taking your calls with Jill Schlesinger of CBSMoneyWatch.com. And Joanne is on the line from, oh, beautiful Carmel, California. Can I come visit?
You can, anytime.
Yeah? Oh, my goodness. That is one of the most beautiful beaches on Earth.
Actually, I'm in Pacific Grove, which is next door to Carmel.
And is it just as beautiful?
It's just as beautiful, yes.
Oh.
A little colder, but just as beautiful.
Lucky, lucky woman, really.
Yes.
I'm going to call you up next time I'm up there.
Oh, lovely.
I think I'm going to have to come with you. I'm going to have to come, obviously.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. It'll be me and Jill knocking on the door. Hey, can we stay? What do you do there in Carmel besides spend beautiful, beautiful hours at the beach?
I'm an immigration lawyer.
Oh,
that must be an interesting thing to do, particularly here in California.
It is interesting.
What's the major issue that you find you're dealing with?
Well, at the moment, and it changes from moment to moment,
yeah.
Really. But right now we're dealing with the deferred action for childhood arrivals, the Dreamers who were brought to this country as minors. And President Obama has launched a program to give them not a whole lot, but they get deferral from deportation for 2 years if they make it.
Right. And this is so that they can go to college without fear of being deported.
At least for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, they can. Well, they can, they can live in peace for a couple of years with the hope that the Congress will enact comprehensive immigration reform.
Well, good for you for helping people through that. How can we help you out today?
Oh, you certainly can help me.
Oh, I hope so.
I'm an avid listener, and I thought, well, maybe they'll have some ideas. I have a modest amount of money to invest, and I'm finding it very difficult to find a money manager to invest this.
Hmm.
My eyes have been opened. Because big investment or brokerage companies don't want to really take much time or give much attention to an account that isn't $500,000 or more.
What is your account?
And it's about $180,000.
Really? And they don't want to manage your money?
I find that they have sort of cookie cutter programs.
Hmm.
You know, like, what is your risk level?
Right, right. Jill, is this fairly common?
Yeah, this is very common with under $250,000 in assets. A lot of the larger firms have basically trying to phase out of that business. You know, from their perspective, they're saying, well, I could give Joanne all of my time and energy. She's got $180,000. Or I can find Joe next door in Carmel down the street who's got $1 million. Same time, I have to do pretty much the same thing. With Joe, I make a lot more money than I can
exactly.
make with Joanne. So it is such a drag. And I've heard this over and over and over again. I assume the reason why you're shopping around is, do you want help with managing the money, or do you want help with managing the money and perhaps some financial planning as well?
Managing the money is my first, mm-hmm. that's my priority.
Right. Okay.
And is this a retirement account or just a savings account?
It's both.
Oh, okay.
Part of it is in an IRA, a traditional, mm-hmm. a smaller amount is in a traditional IRA. And then I have a larger Roth IRA.
Okay. Well, so Jill, where does she go to get some help with trying to figure out where to put this money?
So you go talk to my friends at the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors.
Oh.
And this is a really awesome organization. And NAPFA, NAPFA.org is the name of the website. And what these folks are is very different than what you may have encountered with perhaps a large brokerage firm or what we call wirehouse in the industry. These are CFPs who are also fiduciaries, which means they have to put your interests first. And they are fee only, meaning that they'll charge you either an hourly fee, they'll charge you a flat rate of some amount to manage your money with a certain minimum. It's very... I think it's very clean. It's a clean model, and they want to work with people like you. Just parenthetically, Tess, when I was a financial advisor, I would not have been able to be a NAPFA member because in my firm, we collected commissions. We sold insurance for our clients.
Well, so they, you were one of those folks who was like, 180?
Yeah, pretty much. No, I loved the $180,000 clients because no one else wanted them. So I always felt like, well, this is great. I can service these folks and they'll stay with me. I think if you walk into a lot of different advisors, they're going to say, oh, here's a woman who's approaching retirement. Let's push some of this money into an annuity, which is a horrible idea. So you're not going to be sold something that you don't need. And I really have come to value these folks. I met with some of the people recently just to kind of grill them a little bit. I was really impressed. And I'm sorry that I wouldn't have been a member, but, you know, it's the old story. You know, I wouldn't want to be a member of any place I could have, you know, club or whatever that Woody Allen line is. But anyway, right. I think that would serve you quite well, Joanne. I would check it out.
You had mentioned financial planning.
Yes,
this could serve that as well, couldn't it?
Yeah, these are folks who are CFPs, and so they take a holistic approach to the financial world in general. And by the way, these people are vetted. It's a pretty rigorous process to be a member, and that's why I think it might be a really good match.
Perfect.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call.
Oh, thank you so much.
Joining me yet again this segment is our dear friend Jill Schlesinger of CBSMoneyWatch.com. Hello again.
Hello, and it is great to be with you.
We are so happy to have you with us, and especially as we have Sally on the line from Columbus, Ohio. Hi there.
Hello.
What do you do there in Columbus?
I'm an editor of elementary education textbooks.
Textbooks? So how often do those have to change?
Well, as often as the market requires, which every couple of years we need to update things. So.
Yeah, because history moves pretty quickly, doesn't it?
It does, although math stays the same.
Well, so how are your finances treating you?
Well, I have an interesting situation that I was hoping you could help me with.
All right, tell us about it.
Through a series of unfortunate circumstances, I lost my home a few years back. I've been staying with relatives since.
Oh, my goodness. Was this part of the housing collapse? Were you underwater?
Partly related to it.
Oh, boy.
But I have this chunk of 401k that is sitting there looking at me. It just occurred to me, could I not take this liquid asset, this 401k, withdraw it? I'm eligible now to withdraw it and turn it into a brick and mortar asset, a house where I could live for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
So you're wondering if you can take out your retirement fund to buy a new house?
Yeah.
Aye. Well, first of all, may I ask how old you are?
I turned 60 yesterday.
Okay, so you are eligible to withdraw, but do you have some other big nest egg sitting somewhere?
I do not.
And how much do you have in your 401k?
It's about $135,000.
Jill?
So the problem is that this is a very tempting question that a lot of people are weighing, just like you. And, you know, I hear it all the time. Well, I'll just take the money out. Then I don't have to pay rent or and I don't really have to worry. And it gives me peace of mind. The problem is that what you are essentially doing is you're converting, as you said, a liquid asset into an illiquid asset. I mean, you can't have a situation where you say, well, I'm taking all this money or even a good chunk of it out and, you know, buy a house. And then what are you going to do? Take your kitchen to the grocery store when you need to buy something? So the problem becomes that you need some funds on which to draw to supplement what will likely be your Social Security check. Now, have you gone to the Social Security website and figured out how much you would receive at 62 or your full retirement age or even age 70?
I have looked at it in general, yeah.
And how much is the amount at, let's say, your full retirement age, because I really hate to draw early if that's possible.
At 66, it's going to be around $1,500 a month.
Uh-huh. And if could you live on $1,500 a month right now or not?
I'm pretty frugal, but it would be tight.
Right. So what I'm thinking is that, you know, if you could live on $1,500 a month, that might be one thing. But if it's tight, then you need the $135,000 to supplement that. And, you know, you say that, you know, if you don't have that money, where do you turn? What happens if you need something? And at least from $135,000, you could take 4% of that out every year, not run out of money, and have that liquid asset available to you if you were to need it. And one other thing I just should mention, a lot of people come into retirement and you think, oh, it's so great, I don't want to have a mortgage, or I want to own my house. I think one of the most overlooked things in retirement is that people come into it with not a large enough nest egg, because they don't realize you could need money for big things like healthcare expenses that are not covered by the system, and for things that you want to do down the line. So not a fan of this idea, I have to say.
Well, and also I think people tend to forget that even if your house is paid off, that doesn't mean that your house is paid off, because what if you end up needing a new roof? You know, what right. if something happens to the house? It's not like you stop paying for the house once the mortgage is gone.
Right.
Sure.
And especially if you can find in your market that renting is a viable option, I think that it's a pretty nice way to have some freedom. You're not tied to a particular house and area. If you know, in 10 years from now, you wanted to do something different, you're not worried about what's going on with the market. You pick up and you leave.
Makes sense.
Does that help you out?
It does a lot. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Sally. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And Jill, we have a few letters from folks who we weren't able to get on the phone, but came in through our email inbox. And Kim wrote in from Sandy, Utah, wanting to know how you determine the appropriate amount of student loan debt to take on. And I think this is a very common question that folks ask. And she's asking it both as a parent, and she teaches personal finance in high school, which, of course, is where a lot of kids are trying to figure out this question. So I don't know. Is there a formula of how you should figure out how much debt you should take on before you graduate and go out into that big, bad world?
I would say that there's almost like a new rule of thumb. And I remember before the recession, I think people just took out gobs of debt and they dealt with it because they knew they'd get a job. They
right.
figured it out. And you can't do that anymore. So what I would say is this. Take a look at your first year's salary and use that as the number that is the maximum amount you can borrow. That's what a lot of education experts that I've spoken to have said to me. So if you're going to be a broadcast journalist and you're going to earn $30,000 a year, $25,000 a year as an entry-level position,
yep.
then you only want to have $25,000 or $30,000 of debt. If you're a software engineer and you're going to earn $75,000, $80,000, maybe even $90,000 that first year out, then you can borrow more. But really use that as the target. And if you don't really know what you're going to be when you grow up, just think about this. If you're a liberal arts major, you probably don't want to borrow much more than $35,000. If you're more of a math science person, you can probably borrow up to twice that.
That's a good rule of thumb. And I think that really is different from even a generation ago. Because only thinking about that first year of the kind of money you're going to make, I don't know, that's not usually a lot of money, which would seem to restrict people in the college choices that they're going to make.
Or it protects them. And,
yeah.
I think that maybe restrict, you're right, absolutely, but it protects you. And think of how much more freedom you'll have down the line and the opportunities and the choices you'll have in your career where you don't feel like you have to take a job that is the highest paying job, but maybe a better job for you and for your career long term.
Okay. And Jennifer wrote in from Houston, Texas, wanting to know the percentage of her monthly take-home pay that she should be spending on expenses. Is there a rule of thumb for percentage of, I guess this would be housing and insurance and, going to the movies?
Right. Well, I think that there have been some general rules of thumb where for housing, a lot of financial planners say 28% of your gross pay or 36%
right.
of your net pay. In terms of, I would look at that as not a bad way to go about it. And then maybe before we get into your other expenses, let's say 10 or 15% for a savings. So we want to pay you first and then back into it. A lot of the things that we come down, we want to make it a formula. It's about your life.
Yep.
So you've got to do the right thing. I know a lot of people, on the coasts will say, are you kidding me? 28% of my gross pay on rent? That's impossible. And it may be harder in some areas, but you live by these rules of thumb. There is something to be said for why they came about in the first place. There is some reason that your parents and my parents and our grandparents somehow or other just kept saying save 10 cents of every dollar you make.
Right.
And it really served them well.
So 10 cents out of every dollar. That's a great rule of thumb. I love that. All right. And we'll be taking more of your calls as we come back with our friend Jill Schlesinger of CBSMoneyWatch.com. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. And let's go to one more phone call. We have Andy on the line from Carlsbad, California. Hi there.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. And you are just down the coastline from us here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And how are things in Carlsbad?
Beautiful. I teach at Carlsbad High School.
What subject do you teach?
Math, actually.
Math?
Geometry and calculus, yeah.
Oh, so how do you put that into play with your finances?
I always joke, don't be silly, that's arithmetic, that's not math.
Andy, I have to admit to you that I loved calculus. Is that a geeky thing to admit to you?
Yes.
I will say it's more likely people come up to me when I say I teach calculus, they cringe. But it's nice to hear that other people like calculus, that's excellent.
And by the way, Jill, you didn't just admit it to Andy.
I know.
No, there are other people listening.
I came out as a calculus fan to the entire world.
And I'm right there with you.
And we love you both for it.
Oh, thank you.
So how can we help you out today, Andy?
So just like so many other people, my house is underwater or upside down or whatever you want to call it. And so I've been sitting down and because, I own a condo and it's underwater and my wife and I have been living there for I think 6 years now. And we have a 14-month-old baby and we're thinking, okay, we've got this growing family and, 2-bedroom condo. The condo was intended to be just an investment to move on to something else. And now, everything's upside down.
Can I ask you how far underwater you are?
You bet. About $80,000. We purchased the place for $380, and I think right now our balance is just under $300, and the value is about $215-ish.
Oh boy! So you've lost to what $150,000 plus in value?
Yeah, pretty much. Yikes. And that's probably up from when it was the lowest. So it's frustrating, and so I've kind of sat down and was thinking about, okay, what are my options? And so I guess that's really the question is, I've considered some options, but I wanted to know what are my best options for selling without doing too much damage to my credit and being able to purchase a house to fit my growing family.
Well, first of all, is your mortgage owned by Fannie and Freddie?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so you could potentially be eligible for one of the government programs, HAMP or HARP, that sort of thing.
Yeah, HARP, the second version of HARP is kind of interesting. The first version really was kind of stinky, but the second version actually has expanded and many more people can actually apply. What's your interest rate right now?
Right now, my interest rate is, let's see, I wrote this down. Where is it? 5.875, so not great. But my question about those is that only affects the interest rate, not the principal, correct?
Yes.
So the downside of that, as far as I see, is, I mean, that's good. It would definitely reduce my monthly payments and it would, I could put more money into savings, but it also resets the loan. I go from having 23 years left on the loan to 30, and the amount of money each month going toward interest versus the principal decreases, or more is going to interest.
And it doesn't do anything in terms of your house still being underwater.
Absolutely. Right. And by resetting the loan, it slows down the rate at which it stops being underwater.
Right, right.
And Tess, is interesting. If you talk to a lot of bankruptcy attorneys and, I get them to kind of admit, hey, really, when is it smart to walk away from these things? They'll often say if you're more than 20% underwater, that's when it's really hard to climb out of the hole.
Right.
And that's where you find yourself more than 20% underwater.
Yeah.
So have you thought about walking away?
Well, so that was the other question. Is it walking away or short sale? I don't know.
Yeah.
The question, my consideration for that was, I've considered it, but the other end of it is it's kind of, there's kind of a karma aspect to it. I mean, you know, I know it's more acceptable nowadays. A lot of people are doing short sales, and I understand that. But I did make the commitment to pay off the loan, and it's not right for me to ask somebody else, even a bank, to pay the difference. And it's also, you know, like I said, I've got a 14-month-old daughter. I don't think it's not a good role to set for the daughter.
Right, but why? What makes you different from a business walking away from its mortgage, which businesses do all the time?
Okay,
why is it any different for you?
I don't know. I hadn't considered
because
that.
He has a soul.
Yeah.
No. Hey, corporations are people
they're
too.
People.
The Supreme Court says.
Well, I think there's also a bigger consideration, which is if you walk away or you have a short sale, what ultimately happens is your credit gets trashed.
Right.
And so then how are you going to buy another house, you know, unless you have piles of money that you haven't disclosed to us, which I doubt you have.
I don't see that happening.
At the very least, it'll make it very difficult to buy another house for at least 3, 5, 7 years.
So right. I would end up renting for that time. Okay.
Yes.
Now, is it an option to buy a house before the short sale with the idea of maybe I'll try renting out the condo, and if that doesn't work, then I'll short sale?
I can't imagine. Jill, you might have a different answer, but I can't imagine any bank is going to look at your current situation with your house and give you another loan.
Right.
I mean, even if you could get it, let's assume you could. You get some, you know, ding-dong who says, oh, yeah, I'll give you the money, right? Okay, let's say you own a house. And now what in my world, I would say you are now long two houses, and this is a very frightening situation to be in, right, in this kind of a market.
Yeah.
And so you say, oh, rent it. Renting always sounds great until you talk to someone who's a landlord who says, yeah, well, except for the 6 months that it's empty or the 3 months before you rent it and then the 2 months after you have to clean up after someone's been in it. So I don't love renting. I don't like the short sale. And I'm not sure walking away makes sense for someone in your situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Jill, this is such a common story that we're hearing these days, and there are no easy answers here. Kind of any decision that you make is going to be a very difficult one.
Right, and you know, if you said to me, Andy, I don't know, maybe if you were in Carlsbad, you went around and you said, you know what, I can rent a really nice house for the three of us, and maybe there'll be a fourth down the line, and the rent is really cheap. And I'm very comfortable with that. And I don't have to own a house in the near term. And I'm willing to take that risk. Then that's something you explore. I will say that if you're going to do something like that, where you're going to walk away or a short sale, please see an attorney. Make sure you understand all the ramifications and you get representation.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay.
So unfortunately, no,
yeah.
No, do there, this, do that from us, but yeah. At least exploring some of your options there.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Andy. And
thank you for
good luck
help.
To you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Jill, thank you so much for joining us for all this great financial advice. It was lovely.
Well, Miss Tess, it was delightful and really such a pleasure to be with you.
All right. And if you missed any part of our show or you just want to go back and listen again, check us out online at marketplace.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. And next week, yet again, we're planning something a little different.
That's right, Tess. It's Kai Rizdahl. Of course, I'm the host of Marketplace, joined by a special guest.
I'm Justin Rowlatt from Business Daily on the BBC World Service. And Kai and I are coming together to debate the issues in front of a live audience.
The issue is the financial crisis and the aftermath. Do we get the banks we deserve? Who's to blame for the financial crisis? The banks or we the people?
Because the truth is, whatever the banks do, we seem to hate them. We don't like it when they make too much money, and we certainly don't like it when they lose too much money.
It's a special collaboration with the BBC World Service Business Daily next weekend in this time slot. Tess?
All right. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Joel Patterson, and Bridget Bodner. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. This is APM.